Welcome back to Talkin' Troy. We're coming in hot off a weekend of strong USC women's basketball, and we'll talk more about that later. But right now, we're opening up the show with football recruiting and some big wins that came over the weekend. I'm joined by Thomas Johnson. Thomas, how's it going?
Dude, it's going to be a good day. I'm expecting a great podcast today.
I'm glad to hear it. And Fernanda Sanchez, how's it going?
Oh, it's going great. I agree. It's going to be a good day.
We've also got Marcus Partida in the house producing. Marcus, what's up?
I'm doing good. Can't wait to hear what y'all have to say about this.
Absolutely. So to start it all off, I'm just going to run down a handful of the recruiting wins that came over the weekend. So firstly, USC flipped defensive lineman Justice Terry from Georgia. He's a a five-star prospect, number 13 in the nation. They also got four-star edge rusher and the best rusher in his class, Isaiah Gibson, also out of Georgia, as well as four-star safety Hilton Stubbs, I hope I'm saying that right, out of Florida. Those were just a handful of the wins, but obviously it's created a lot of buzz around the program, especially on the defensive side of the ball. And a lot of this is down to new defensive line coach Eric Henderson. So Thomas, what did you make of the weekend's recruiting wins, and what do you think it signals for the program going forward?
Well, it's crazy because the last time USC has signed, and look, Justice Terry isn't signed yet. There's a lot of time before signing day, which will happen in December. That's only the early signing day. USC has not signed a five-star defensive lineman out of California since 2013. That's been 11 years, and that's according to the 24/7 sports composite rankings. I know you use a little bit different of the rankings, but that's just momentum. That is program momentum. And how long has Henderson been at the helm? A couple months, maybe? And the quiet period had just ended at the beginning of March, and he has a five-star recruit flip to him. That is impressive. Just like hands down impressive. And then that just builds momentum. You know, you want one or two cornerstone recruits to build your class around. And now the Trojans have them, and we're sitting in March before the season even starts, between Justice Terry and Julian Lewis, another five-star who's been committed for a while. But those are two cornerstones you can build your class around.
And both guys from Georgia, right in the Bulldogs' backyard. Obviously, Georgia has won two out of the last three national championship titles. So going to that state, which USC doesn't have much of a history in, at least recently, and winning those battles is huge, not just because of the quality of the prospects, but just kind of the geographic nature of college football and putting a stamp in a region that, you know, it looks like USC might have a real presence in going forwards. But Fernanda, what did
correct.
You think?
I mean, we're heading into the Big Ten, aren't we?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And you have to recruit nationally if you want to win. If you want to win titles,
exactly,
you have to have a national reach. So there was another commitment from the weekend, less acclaimed, at least from a rankings perspective, but got a lot of buzz on social media, not necessarily positive buzz. His name is Gus Cordova. He's also a defensive lineman out of Austin, Texas. On the one hand, it's encouraging that USC is really focusing on the defensive line. But Thomas, could you tell us a little bit more about, you know, why Cordova is kind of on the hot seat right now and what's going on with him?
Yeah, so it's really interesting. Within the past couple years, while he was at high school, Gus had a teammate who had a life-threatening peanut allergy. And the reports are saying, and they've both confirmed it, both Gus and the teammate, that Cordova had asked him, is it life-threatening? Teammate said yes, but apparently Cordova didn't believe him. So as kind of a prank or whatever type of thing, he put peanuts in the teammate's locker room. And luckily, at least from the report I read, before the teammate had actually gone to the locker room, he removed the peanuts. I think he felt bad because it was Gus and another teammate who tried to pull this quote-unquote prank. And the teammate eventually showed up. There were peanut dust still like littered around his locker, and it was an airborne allergy. So he broke out into hives, and it's just really, really concerning. As somebody who has a peanut allergy myself, like, sure, jokes are made. Like, I got threatened to have peanut butter smeared on me back middle school. Luckily, that never happened. And so it's just a little concerning that this wasn't a joke. This was an actual action that was taken. And luckily, I think he realized what he was doing was wrong in the moment by removing the peanuts from the locker room. But still, it's something he did. He's a high schooler. I believe in second chances. And the only thing is, is it worth the controversy? Because he's a three-star, according to 24/7 Sports, ranked in the 500s nationally. I don't know if he's worth the headache. And I feel really bad saying, like, oh, you can brush over character issues if they're a Brett or recruit. But in a situation like this, like, there is some character issues that are present, at least in this one instance. I don't really know. I've never met the guy. I'm not Lincoln Riley. If I was Lincoln Riley and I had problems with his character, I wouldn't have recruited him. Obviously, that's not the case for the USC coaching staff. It's just a little bit concerning.
No, yeah, I definitely agree. I think when you are being recruited as a top, like if you are a national player or if you're a top player or anything, you really have to be careful during the off season, right? You have to be really careful about what you're saying, what you're doing. And I think I agree with you on that. Like what he was doing about, like, you know, the controversy back when he was in middle school, you said?
No. This happened within the last 2 years.
Oh, wow.
When he was high school, like high school football teammate.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. What this made me think of kind of was one of the pieces that came out on The Athletic in the wake of Jimbo Fisher's departure from Texas A&M was that during his time, he was really chasing this like number one overall recruiting class and was brushing over character concerns for the sake of signing 4 stars and 5 stars. But Gus is a 3-star, you know, like you don't necessarily have to take the risk. On the other hand, you know, we have a hot new defensive line coach who has seen firsthand, you know, Aaron Donald, what it takes to be one of the best quarterback like threats of all time, basically. So if he sees something in Cordova that he can mold, you know, you want to go with him on that assessment. But it is kind of weird. Like by the age of 15, 16, 17, you should know not to mess around with peanut allergies. Mm-hmm. Like obviously he's still a young kid, still growing, you know, mentally as well as physically, hopefully. But by the time you're in high school, you would think that's something that you know not to do.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like from my perspective, when I first read the story, I'm like, yeah, this is bad. I think people are overblowing it because there's been a lot of false reports. Like I saw the comments when Hayes Fawcett, who releases a lot of these commitments on social media, he does a great job. He was the one who released the commitment for Cordova. And you just look at the comments, people are saying, oh, he killed his teammate and it was covered up. He didn't kill his teammate. His teammate is still alive. He kind of regretted his actions, obviously, in the moment. I thought that was overblown. Then I realized it was an airborne allergy, and I don't have an airborne peanut allergy, so it's a little bit different circumstances for me, because for an airborne allergy, it's just if the item is in the air, that's when you can break out and have a reaction. It only happens to me if I touch it or eat it, so it's definitely a little different scenario, but obviously people are blowing it out of the water. Like, he's not dead. His teammate's not dead.
Yeah.
Just need to put that out there. So.
No, agreed.
But yeah, I mean, it's been a big weekend. Henderson is now ranked the third best recruiter in the country, according to 247. And obviously, he brings a lot of gravitas with him because of his time in the NFL and coaching Aaron Donald. I want to bring up a quote here of Aaron Donald speaking about Henderson and what he'll bring to USC, because I think it's really exciting. Donald said, "They're going to be technically sound. There's going to be a bunch of dogs flying around, playing mean, playing fast, and the chemistry they're going to have together as a group with Coach Henny there, it's going to be like no other, man. They're going to have a lot of success. As long as they have Coach Henny, I know from personal experience, seeing what he did with our group, with me personally, I've got nothing but love for Coach Henny." So, you know, Donald also recently retired. Mm-hmm. Maybe he'll be around the practice facility from time to time. That would be a big role model for people to look up for.
I mean, what a recruiting chip saying, yes, I have this 3-time AP Defensive Player of the Year coming to practices. I coached him. Like, what a recruiting chip you can use. And again, I kind of emphasized this earlier. Henderson has been the defensive line coach for just over 2 months. And he's already recruiting at this level. And this is coming from the NFL, where you don't have to recruit. That's all the front office who signs the free agents. How? I just don't understand how you can flip a 5-star so quickly from Georgia, his home state, Terry's.
I think that's almost the most impressive thing about Henderson, is that he took almost like a lateral move to come to college football. I mean, he's obviously has, you know, a little bit more presence, but he was a D-line coach of the Rams. He's a D-line coach at USC. You know, that's not a huge change in responsibilities, and he's hitting the recruiting trail really hard in a way that people want to get out of college football for right now because it's even harder to recruit than ever and retain commitments due to NIL, due to the transfer portal.
And the NFL job is much easier because you don't have that recruiting aspect. You don't have to be on the road in the offseason. During the offseason, you can just spend time at home, you know, game plan for the next season as an NFL coach. That's not the case as a college coach. So I'm just impressed at Henderson. But yeah, back to the players themselves, it's a national thing. Like, there's not a single California recruit in this 2025 class. It's Justice Terry, like you said, Julian Lewis, the quarterback, Hilton Stubbs, Isaiah Gibson, Cus Cordova, three Georgians, one Floridian, and Texas. Texas is the closest state here in this recruiting class. That's just impressive. It's the three Georgian players that I really want to talk about because all of them are top 100 recruits, being Terry, Lewis, and Gibson. Terry and Lewis are top 10 recruits, depending on the sites you look at. Is USC in contention for the number one overall class? Currently, they have the number 11 ranked class, but that's just due to a lack of numbers of commits. That's a volume thing. But their average recruit ranking is a 95.90, which Ohio State has a better ranking than that. But at least looking at this list firsthand, no one above that. So it's just Ohio State, then USC.
And Ohio State has been one of the most dominant recruiting teams for the last decade. So to be just in the same conversation is a win.
Yeah. I'm just excited to see who USC is going to recruit at the end of the day.
I mean, yeah, hopefully there's a lot more coming. And I mean, the Georgia thing has momentum even before Henderson got here. One of the top two prospects in USC's 2024 class, which has been signed, some of whom are on campus in spring ball, one of which is Cameron Fountain, who is a number 58 overall edge rusher in the country from Atlanta. So, like, Lincoln Riley and co. are reaching out across the country to bring these guys in, which is interesting because USC has typically had such a California-focused recruiting base. And I wonder if part of the national reach is coming from NIL efforts, which Riley recently said have kind of been pumped up as late. He said, NIL has taken some monster leaps in the last several months, which has been positive. I think for everybody, our fan base and supporters, it's just been gaining an understanding of what is and how it's not important. It's imperative.
Yeah, it's so interesting because we see at the beginning of Riley's tenure, he kind of takes a no stance on NIL. It's like, oh, we're not going to pay for our players. They're going to come here on their own volition. We're going to help them get to the league. That was their pitch. And now we're seeing, at least according to him, these NIL ventures that are going well. I mean, we see Caleb Williams, all of his NIL deals. I don't want to speculate on the amount of money he's making, but he has a deal with Beats. That's just one of the few, very high level. So it's very, very impressive. But yeah, back to the Georgia thing. Other than Fountain, USC had two other Georgian recruits in that recruiting class last year. So maybe we're getting a Georgia to USC, the state of Georgia. The state of Georgia to USC pipeline?
Come on. That would be awesome. I mean, Barry Alexander, before that, obviously a Texas prospect, but spent time with the Bulldogs. So, you know, like, if that's an area that we're focused on geographically, that's very positive. That's just very positive. And I think there's still so much to come from this 2025 class. You know, linebackers coach Matt Entz, comes from the Midwest with North Dakota State. So that's a whole nother part of the country that they have a good footprint in and could potentially make some progress.
Yeah, and we already mentioned it, but they don't have a single California recruit in their class. They're going to get at least one or two.
Yeah,
or
you know,
three.
Something's going to come.
It's a California thing, and I don't want to speculate, but a lot of the top linebackers in this class are from California. They've already had ties to USC, so if you can get that pipeline coming, you have the California recruits and these highly rated national top recruits, we might be looking at a top five class, which Lincoln Riley hasn't had in his time at USC.
I agree. I mean, we should talk about the incoming class that's coming in, too, and the freshmen who played, like Zachariah Branch. Who else am I missing, guys?
Well, Jacoby Lane was another standout in the Holiday Bowl game. Mekhi Lemon.
Lolo, I think he's coming in.
So I think, you know, even though there's a lot of receivers on their way out, either via the transfer portal or the draft, obviously they're losing Brendan Rice, Taj Washington, Mario Williams transferred to Tulane. But it seems like there's a really good young core of receivers. Deuce Robinson, also one of the guys we didn't mention just now. But like, they're going to step up, and they looked ready to play a lot of college ball in the Holiday Bowl, where they trounced Louisville.
This is finally becoming Lincoln Riley's team, because obviously he had to take over Clay Helton's team, which we all know was not very good. Now he's able to bring in his own recruits, obviously relied on the transfer portal a lot the first 2 years, but he didn't make the note that he wanted to shift more to high school recruiting. And we're seeing it happen firsthand. He has a great recruiting staff. And to bring examples to the California conversation, USC has been connected to Dijon Lee, a cornerback from California, Noah Mikhail from Laverne, California. He's a linebacker, a four-star, but still a top 100 recruit. So California's coming to USC. The nation is coming to USC. Again, a long time until signing day. So, Jack, I want to ask you, are you worried at all that even though it's a verbal commitment, the Trojans won't be able to lock down their signature come December?
I mean, that's a concern for every program, though. I don't think USC has any particular reason to worry about that. And what's more important than the names that we're talking about is just the momentum. You know, as long as USC is able to continue getting verbal commitments, getting hard commitments, you know, if you lose a couple prospects, like I know there's a lot of anxiety that Julian Lewis will eventually take an even bigger NIL deal from like Ohio State, or maybe he goes back to Georgia. Or he never committed to Georgia, but he ends up signing with Georgia.
Luckily, I think Georgia just got a verbal commitment from another quarterback, maybe not in the 2025 class, but the 2026. So okay,
maybe that puts them off.
That waylaid my fears just a little bit. But yeah, that's been the biggest rumor that Julian Lewis will decommit.
But yeah, I think, you know, USC has no more reason to worry about that kind of thing than any other program in the country. And as long as you build yourself up as a desirable place to come with strong recruiters, with a lot of personality on your coaching staff, like I think they have nothing to worry about.
Agreed. Yeah, I mean, have we talked about DeCarlis Nicholson yet?
Oh, yeah, the transfer.
From Mississippi State?
Yeah, I think he'll be fine. I don't know. It's kind of tough. Mississippi State's not the best program in the SEC. He's a good transfer. He was a good pickup. But again, I think it's more important now that the Trojans get the high school recruits, because we've been seeing they're getting these rentals, these 1 year, maybe 2 years. We've seen a couple of examples with that.
And some of them work out and some of them don't. Obviously, yeah. Jordan Addison and Caleb Williams were the best case scenario. And then, you know, this year, a lot of them haven't gone to plan. Like Anthony Lucas was very hyped out of Texas A&M. He hasn't had much of a presence. So
luckily he's still young. So that could
still time.
But again, yeah, that's you don't want the 1 year rentals. You want the long term. You can have them for 2-3 years and for high school, and you can leave for the draft early or enter the transfer portal, but they can't enter the draft until after their junior year. So you get them at least for 3 years, assuming they stay with the Trojans for the entire year. So I think USC definitely needs to have a larger focus on high school recruiting. Lincoln Riley had to do what he did in his first year to make sure he could field a team. Obviously, bring in Caleb Williams. If you get Caleb Williams, you take it from the transfer portal. But yeah, it's important that USC focuses on high school recruiting at this point.
Yeah.
And I think I like what you said, Thomas, about Lincoln putting his stamp on this team. And I think take that one step further. This offseason, he completely refocused on defense. And we're seeing the early recruiting results of that as well. Not just on the defensive line, but also for 2026, new secondary coach Doug Belk got a commitment from Dominic Kelly, who obviously it's a long way out. We'll see if he ever signs for USC, but he's a cornerback out of Florida, I believe, who also had offers from Georgia, Penn State, and Notre Dame. So we'll see what his eventual ranking is, but the fact that he had those offers signals that he's a very solid defensive player. Yeah. And they're kind of spreading the love across the defensive lines, not just, in the trenches.
Yeah, you guys brought up earlier like a matter of getting the sign in the end. But really, I think just the size of this recruiting class and how well they've been doing so far is what's going to keep those signages. Like Julian Lewis, you said how there's worries about him committing elsewhere. He's been taking visits to Colorado. But I think that what they've been doing with this team right now, all these recruits coming in, is what's going to keep Julian Lewis here. And along with all those other guys that have already said, oh yeah, I'll go to USC. Now that they're seeing that this team is becoming what it is, they're all going to stay here.
Well.
Whoa.
Weight-wise, sure, they look like they're improving. The team has momentum, but we can't forget the defensive output that was last year. They have to show it on the field that they can actually play good defense. Yeah. That's the biggest concern here. If USC wants to sign all of these recruits, they got to put a good product on the field in September through hopefully January if they can make it to the college football playoff. So that's the biggest concern at this point. Just because they have momentum, they got to be able to use it.
No, yeah, I definitely agree. I mean, my first year, I'm a first year, by the way. I came in thinking like, oh my gosh, like USC football. Oh my gosh, like, you know. But then I saw them play. I mean, I saw USC play. And I was like, whoa, our offensive linemen, we need work. Yeah, we just need work. And I feel like Lincoln Riley is putting in that work to recruit players.
Hopefully. but back to your point, Jack. We talked about in the 2025 class, no Californians. That 2026 class, other than Dominic Kelly, the other three recruits in that class from California. So it's just funny and good that USC can have that mix of, oh, we can go across the country to get recruits, but we're also going to try to lock down Southern California. We haven't seen it in the 2025 class, but a good start in the 2026 class.
So what are you trying to say about California?
What am I trying to say about California? What do you mean?
You mentioned California a lot.
Because we're in California.
Yeah.
Okay. Any last recruiting notes, Jack?
No, I like what Marcus said there about using the rest of the recruiting class to continue convincing Julian Lewis to eventually sign with USC, because I think it will be nice to be able to tell Julian Lewis and future quarterbacks, like, I know what you saw with Caleb and how he had to score 45 points every single game to keep us in it, but actually we're getting you defensive support. Mm-hmm. There's going to be more effort on that side of the ball, and you should only have to average, your offense should only have to average, you know, 30, 35 points a game to win these ball games, instead of literally going out every single possession with the imperative being to score a touchdown. Yeah. And that was a very stressful environment, it seems like, for Caleb, and he did very well with it. But it's an unreasonable expectation to have to get bailed out by, you know, your all-star quarterback every single game. And just not as conducive to strong development. But I think going forward, it's just going to be more of a balanced effort.
Mm. And to end on a final note, I don't know if anyone wants to say anything else, but Zachariah Branch recently signed with the track and field team. So I thought that was really cool.
He has been competing on that front this year. And, you know, he has the speed to burn. So pretty sweet. Anything else?
No. Momentum. Program momentum is what USC team needs. That Louisville win, I think, was huge. I don't know if that's really shown in the recruiting aspect of it, but obviously the new defensive coaching staff has, which I think is very important.
And we will be right back with a segment about USC women's basketball and the wins they had over Kansas and Texas A&M Corpus Christi very soon.
Welcome back to Talkin' Troy. Like Jack said, I'm Thomas Johnson here with Casey Kasliner, Darren Perry, and Michelle Chavez. The USC women's basketball team is still dancing. I don't know if any of us could have predicted this season happening like this, but they're going on to the Sweet 16. They took down Kansas at Galen Center 73-55 this past Monday. It was awesome. An 18-point win for a game that was only a one-point game really late in the third quarter, but the Trojans turn it on to take the game by 18 points after beating Texas A&M Corpus Christi 87-55 in the first round. So guys, talk observations. All of you were at the Monday night game versus Kansas. Talk observations, and then we'll preview USC's matchup with the Baylor Bears in Portland this upcoming weekend. Darren, I'll start with you. What was your biggest observation about this team versus Kansas?
You know, my first observation is the atmosphere was just electric. Galen was rocking the whole time. That was one of the craziest I've seen it, like, other than like a UCLA game. So that was amazing to see. And I think the thing that stood out to me the most was you mentioned how it was a one-point game in the third quarter. And Kansas, they sort of switched to like a zone, like a 1-3-1 zone. And USC kept putting shots up, shots after shots up. Some of them went in. And then USC just was on the offensive boards. Clarice Akinwafo, she came up huge for the Trojans in the end. She only had 9 rebounds on the game, which seemed like much more. She had a bunch of offensive rebounds, and I think that was the game changer. Her coming off the bench with Rhea Marshall in foul trouble, that was huge. Casey?
Yeah, well, I think the Trojans kind of, and I was talking with you, Thomas, during the game about this. They were putting up a lot of three-point shots. And, yes, mm-hmm. they weren't hitting them.
They still went 13 for 30. That's a pretty good percentage.
But they had stretches, I think, where they didn't. And I think the thing with this team that we've learned throughout this season, especially with Juju, and it's not any it's not a knock against any of their games. Efficiency doesn't mean that you're necessarily having – it doesn't correlate to success. That's what I'm trying to say. You can have an inefficient game and still win by the amount of points they did. Juju will have certain nights where she isn't super efficient. And we saw in this game, I mean, she was 9 of 21, not horrible. But players like Mackenzie Forbes, who has been a star, superstar, one could say, in the past five or so games, leading from the Pac-12 tournament to NCAA tournament, she was 6 of 19 but still put up 20 points. And so I think this team – is kind of going by the motto of, you know, we'll give you a little bit, but we'll take even more. And I think they're really doing a good job from behind the arc. And I think, that, like Darren said, the depth. I mean, having Akinwafu come in on limited minutes and not just get rebounds, but six blocks. I mean, that was electric to see, especially against a Kansas team that kind of thrives off Tyana Jackson in the middle. And so, yes, they did get, you know, Samaya Nichols had 22 points, but I feel like by and large, USC was shutting them down in the starting lineup and their bench did nothing.
I agree with both of you. However, one thing that I noticed and the people that were around me that really noticed this is they relied a lot on Juju when she wasn't having her best night for the first two quarters. And it was kind of stressful to see. Obviously, she's amazing. Obviously, like we were in the lead the whole time. There wasn't a single point in the game where we were under, but it still didn't mean that they should have relied on her as much as she did. I think as much as they did, actually. I think one of the biggest stressors was the fact that it wasn't like the Corpus Christi game where from the very beginning we knew that USC was going to win. Like, there was no shot that Corpus Christi was ever going to come even near them, and USC dropped like 30 points. But for this game, Kansas had a really good shot at winning at times, and I think it was scary to watch as an outside perspective, to see them, like, there was a lot of times where they didn't have to pass to Juju and she didn't make the shots that she took. There were other players that they could have passed to. And I think Kansas saw some of that as a little way that they could add more pressure in different points during the game. So I think it was really difficult at times, but overall it was a good game. I'm not saying that they had a bad game.
Yeah, I mean, at this point we're just nitpicking because Juju Watkins, like, this has been the whole season for her. Sometimes she's not the most efficient, but she still is going to put up those shots. Juju is a player that has to put up shots, and if they're misses, they're misses, because she takes really difficult shots, and she'll make a handful of them. She won't make every one just because of the difficulty, but I don't know if that's necessarily a knock on USC's game. I think they have to play that way. And to bite back on your point, Michelle, Kansas was never going to win this game. They never led. And sure, they made it a one-point game in the third quarter, but then USC showed why they're their number one seed. They had a very nice sequence of events. Juju Watkins hit a three-pointer. Then she, on the very next possession, hit two free throws. Then Mackenzie Forbes gets a steal. Clarice Akinwafo hits another free throw to make it a seven-point game leading into the fourth quarter. So although Kansas made it close, I was never worried that the Trojans were going to lose the game. And it ended 18 points, like an 18-point margin. And sure, it was a number one seed versus a number eight seed. You kind of expect that. But I think it's unfair to say it was worrisome that USC might lose that game. I don't know if Darren or Casey, either of you, agree with that.
Yeah, I agree with it. I also think, you know, when we're talking about Juju, every team is watching her and creating a defense and a game plan around her. And so I think at the end of the day, Juju might be taking sometimes inefficient shots, but she's also going to the free throw line a lot. And it's not because she's flopping. She isn't. It's because she's always driving down the lane, and teams are very physical with Juju. I mean, you could see it, you know, from the jump. This was a physical, hard-fought game by both teams. And I agree. I think really, I mean, what they're doing is winning. I mean, they're on a seven-game win streak. USC had, you know, dating back to, you know the Pac-12s and everything. And they have a winning formula. It's get Juju the ball, and when Juju's not scoring, McKenzie's probably the one scoring. And when she's not scoring, it's probably Marshall in the middle. Like, you have your top three very much laid out. And I think Juju, just because we talk about how good of a basketball player is, but I think more importantly, she has so much determination. She has so much of a will to play. I mean, she'll play, you know, close to 40 minutes every night, you know, in those closer games, and she doesn't really show any sign of slowing down. And I think that comes with, you know, yes, the teams are throwing everything they have at her, and that's obvious because, you know, she's a top two player in the country, I would argue. And I just think, you know, she's getting to the free throw line, and that's a really smart part of her game because she's getting those calls because, you know, she shot 8 free throws last game. She's had games where she shot more than 10, and I think it's a really good part of her game, and it's not anything against her because she's not flopping. Again, she's not, but she's just getting crazy defenses and physical play thrown at her.
Well, let's move on. We've talked about USC's win over Kansas, but now it's time to preview USC's matchup with the number 5 seeded Baylor Bears. They're playing them in Portland this upcoming Saturday at 2:30 p.m. Trojans and the Bears have only played twice in their history. Series is tied 1-1. Those games were played in 1999 and 2000. I think that's pretty interesting. It's been 24 years, nearly 24 years since they last played each other. And I know we probably are not the biggest Baylor Bears aficionados when it comes to knowledge, but what do you think are the keys to the game for USC to win?
Yeah, I was talking to Lindsey Gottlieb today, and she was talking about how Baylor, while they are undersized compared to USC and some other teams, their bigs play really, really hard. Because you got to remember, these players have been playing undersized as centers their whole career. So they've mastered this craft. And obviously, there's 16 teams left. Any team at this point is a hard-fought team. But their guards have been the headlining, you know, part of their game. They beat Virginia Tech coming into this. Of course, Virginia Tech, you know, made headlines when Elizabeth Kitley, you know, All-American, tore her ACL. And they only won, Baylor only won by 3 points. So I think that keep that in mind. You defeat Virginia Tech, who doesn't have their best player, only by 3 points. And given, you know, Baylor is a 5 seed, but there's a lot, I think there's a lot of disparity between, you know, a 1 seed and a 5 seed. So I still do think USC is going to win by a significant margin.
What's your definition of significant?
I think more than 10 points. But
okay,
we got to remember, though, they are an extremely deep team, okay? Junior guard Jada Walker, okay? I honestly didn't know who she was because she wasn't even averaging more than 10 points prior to last game. She's coming off a career high in March Madness. I mean, it's hard to get hot, you know, at this time when, you know, the lights are on you and you're playing away from your home arena. To get a career high in March Madness, Walker had an incredible game, and that was against Virginia Tech, and they won by 3 in what was a thriller. Bella Fauntleroy has been, you know, very, very good for them. She was good in their first round matchup, and that was against Vanderbilt, and they won that as expected. That Vanderbilt was a 12 seed, and she had a double-double in that game. So, you know, their guards are getting rebounds too, and USC could see that too. I mean, you know, Watkins has gotten rebounds in big numbers as well. So they're a smaller team. You know, I see Baylor as a smaller team that plays big. And I think USC will keep that in mind now with the surging Clarice Akinwafu.
All right, before I kick it over you to Darren and Michelle, ESPN currently has the spread of this game at 3.5 points. USC is favored by 3.5 points. So keep that in mind before you say what you're about to say. Darren?
You know, I mean, before you said that, they do cover the 3.5. I do think that. But I do
USC
think...
USC does, yeah.
Yes. Yeah. But I do think us as USC fans, the USC fans community, I think they are overlooking Baylor. I mean, Casey, you mentioned that there's a lot of disparity within a 5 and a 1 seed. I honestly don't really see it that way. Maybe in the women's game. But I think this is a huge matchup. I mean, Baylor, they won their first 15 games of the season. They started off 15-0, and but that said, they did end the season 10-7, so they did have a little of a rough patch then. And they also, in common opponents, they lost to Kansas 87-66.
87-66?
Yes, which does not look good at all for them, at least.
When was that game?
That was in the middle of the season.
Okay.
I have USC winning against Baylor. I think they can definitely do it. We've seen that with the last two performances. I do think this game is going to be a lot closer. It's not going to be a 20-30 point difference. I know it's like a 3.5 lead with USC that's being predicted. I think it's going to be more of like a 10-point lead, honestly. But as Casey was saying, like, Baylor has really strong bigs that are leading, but also Juju recently just said that our bigs, like Clarissa and Mackenzie, are really good opponents for them, so I don't think we should be that worried for that front. I do think USC is going to come in, and they should be very aggressive from the beginning. But, you know, historically we've seen Baylor go and reach to the Elite Eight, and so I think it's going to be a matchup where none of them can afford to make any sort of mistakes. And so what they're going to do is they're going to obviously let Juju do her thing and obviously let Mackenzie and the Kaylas, like Padilla, also kind of shoot more. I think, I don't know if the lineups are going to be different than what we've seen before. Obviously, we have the starting six, but I think what they're going to do is what USC should do is move the ball around a lot more before they get to Juju in order.
What's interesting here is I agree that it's going to be a closer game. I'm not as optimistic as Casey, though. I think it's going to be definitely less than a 10-point margin. Covering 3.5, that's tough. I'm going to say USC covers that, but it's going to be definitely less than 10 points because we look at what Baylor just did. They upset Virginia Tech on Virginia Tech's home court. And sure, Virginia Tech missing Kittley, that's very important, big piece for them. But now USC is playing at a neutral site. They had the gift of playing at Galen Center for their first two NCAA tournament games. Sure, that kind of gives you a home sense, but now these players are really being thrown into the fire. Mackenzie Forbes has had tournament experience, but she lost in the round of 32 when she was a freshman at Cal. Rhea Marshall hasn't made it past the round of 64 before this year. Juju Watkins is obviously a freshman. We might now finally start to see the lack of experience bleeding through. Do I think USC still wins this game? Sure, but the lack of experience is going to come through a lot more this weekend than it has in the first two games.
But Thomas, they played on a neutral site the entire Pac-12, and they went perfect in the best conference in America. So I don't really see the neutral site argument as completely valid, especially considering it's in Portland. Let's be real. There's going to be a lot more. If there are a lot of USC fans, it's going to be an overwhelmingly more amount than Baylor fans, I think. I think, you know, distance is closer. It's one state away. But I think all that aside,
Texas fans will travel a lot more than USC fans, I bet. I don't know if it's going to be, like, more Baylor fans, but it's going to be a lot closer than you
think. Bet your bottom dollar on that.
I'll put best case scenario, USC 65% fans, Baylor 35%.
Well, yeah, that's best still case. The majority. That's great. And
it's not like 90-10 like it was this week, though. I think it's going to be very important. I think that's going to be a big difference in this upcoming two matches.
I think the X factor that we haven't spoke about yet was Dreyuna Edwards. She's been Baylor's leading scorer all year. She's a forward. They kind of run, you know, like a mostly guard lineup. They're, like I said, they're undersized. But she only tallied 7 points in each of the first two rounds. You know, obviously, first game, they didn't really need it. But second, I mean, that's your leading scorer. You know, we don't see that from Juju. And I know they're more spread out than USC in terms of talent and scoring. But still, I that would alarm me a little bit. And, you know, Sarah Andrews, we didn't talk about her. She's been electric all season. She had double-digit performances in rounds one and two. And so I think USC has the upper hand because they have the two centers in Akinwafo and Marshall have been stout on defense these past 2 weeks and before that even. And I think Marshall, like, her growth has been so immense from towards the beginning of the season and midseason when she really wasn't that involved on offense or defense, picking up fouls, to now. I think they're peaking at the right time. They're getting hot at the right time. And I agree. I could see it being a closer game because it's March Madness. You can't ever really predict the score. You can't really ever predict the winner, if we're being honest. But I think USC has the upper hand with the size. And that's, to me, the biggest thing, especially in women's basketball.
Yeah. What's interesting is Baylor, I find to be a little bit similar to Colorado. And like you said, the scoring is spread out a lot. Like you said, Dreyuna Edwards only averages 11.7 points per game. Their third leading scorer, Dariana Littlepage-Bugs, 10.5. That's a 1.2 point margin between their leading scorer and their third, compared to Colorado, which has a very similar, even though Colorado has a better offense. So in that way, USC struggled with Colorado in their first matchup. You know, that was in the Rocky Mountains. Altitude played a factor. It was earlier in the season. But you could see that play style messing up the Trojans a little bit, even though USC did beat Colorado towards the end of the season to avenge that loss. I don't know. I do think USC wins this game, but people are underestimating the Baylor Bears.
I think you bring up a point, too, because we haven't really seen much from Kayla Padilla lately or the other guards. Like, Mackenzie Forbes and Juju Watkins have been just forces lately, and I don't really see much from the other guards lately. And given they don't really have
to. You don't need to.
You don't need to. But, I think it's going to be interesting when you have a Padilla guarding, you know, one of those top three scorers potentially. And so I think that's something that they'll have to figure out. I think defense is a big part of this game because I think, you know, when you have your guard spread out, you have sharpshooters on the wing, you have sharpshooters up top, you have shooters everywhere, and that's, they're known for their guard play. I mean, they're a good team because of that. They're at the Sweet 16 because of that. So they're going to have to defend, USC's going to have to defend that.
Well, it should be really interesting if USC, they're in the Sweet 16 for the first time since 1994, will play in the Elite Eight if they beat the Baylor Bears, and they'll play UConn or Duke, which should be a great matchup. Casey and I will both be up there reporting live for the Daily Trojan. That should be pretty exciting. And hopefully for USC fans, the Trojans will advance to that Elite Eight matchup. But that is all the time we have today for Talkin' Troy. See you next week. This episode of Talkin' Troy was hosted by Thomas Johnson, Michelle Chavez, Darren Perry, Casey Kasliner, Jack Hallinan, Marcus Partida, and Fernanda Sanchez. Edited by Jack Hallinan and produced by Jack Hallinan and Jonathan Park. Talkin' Troy is one of three episodes on the Daily Trojan Podcast Network. You can listen to all of our episodes anywhere you listen to podcasts or on our website, dailytrojan.com.